Hello, Tomorrow Built Today listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Jana Messerschmidt. For those of you new to the podcast, we cover investing trends and predictions, along with discussions about the latest news in consumer tech. This week, we're doing something a little bit different. We are bringing you three of the talks from Lightspeed's first negotiation summit with Hashtag Angels, Demystifying Power and Wealth in the Valley. It recently took place at Twitter. You'll hear from top negotiators, founders, and investors to hear the tips for negotiating in the Valley. One note to keep in mind is that because we recorded this live, which included a lot of hand gestures and animation from the speakers, the voice quality isn't perfect, but the content makes up for it.
So next up is Maggie Neal. Maggie is the Adams Distinguished Professor of Management at Stanford GSB. She's also the co-director of Stanford GSB's Executive Program for Women Leaders and director of the Influence and Negotiation Strategies Program. So I think we got the right person in the room here to talk about this today. She's done extensive research on negotiation and team performance, and she's even written 5 books on the topic in her spare time. No big deal. Her latest book is titled Getting More of What You Want, How the Secrets of Economics and Psychology Can Help You Negotiate Anything in Business and in Life. It's a must read. We're excited to give everybody free copies of it today that Maggie got here at 8 a.m. and signed. So thank you. With that, Maggie.
Thanks. Following Henry, who said, you shouldn't negotiate, it's a bad thing. Here I am. Okay. Well, there are a lot of things that he said which were absolutely true, and there were a few things that you might take a little issue with, but that's fine. But what I want to talk about is negotiating broadly, because the questions that were asked, do women negotiate? You know, we see them negotiating as less than men. We see that when they ask, they aren't as effective when they negotiate. That's not just at the ask at the recruitment and hiring stage. This goes on throughout your economic life. And so part of what I want to talk about today is how do you get more of what you want? And I want to focus on the uneven playing field that exists for women and the strategies and tactics that we can use to mitigate the unevenness, not remove it. Were we all in a world where the playing field was level, I will admit that's a world I would like to see. But until we get there, we've got to be different. And so the first thing I want to suggest is that when we think about negotiation, most of us are already at a disadvantage because we view negotiation as a battle. And that battle is characterized by, I'm going to try to get stuff from you that you don't want me to have, and I'm going to try to keep you from getting my stuff. And if that's how you think about negotiation, you're already in an uphill climb. Because you're already creating the situation that Henry talked about, which is people get upset and angry and they feel ripped off, right? Doesn't matter what you get, you think I could have gotten more. And so what it also does, which I think is really damaging, is that when you think about negotiation as battle, it becomes a filter through which you evaluate your counterpart's behavior. They're the enemy, they're the other. They are the person who is keeping you from getting what it is you want. And so that filter creates the most malevolent interpretation of their behavior because they are the other. But in addition, all of a sudden, the negotiation comes from thinking about getting more of what you want to winning. And sometimes when we focus on winning, that becomes more important than what it is we have won. And it also turns out that while there are some negotiations that are adversarial, that are characterized by a pitched battle, most of the people with whom you negotiate are people with whom you are in a relationship or have the potential for a relationship. And so what happens is if you think of negotiation as this battle, you're going to pick and choose your negotiations based upon a negotiation that's sufficiently important enough that you're willing to pick a fight with someone with whom you have an ongoing interaction. And which means you stop yourself from negotiating in so many situations. So the first thing I want you to do is to actually think about broadening your definition of negotiation, to move from the notion of negotiation as a battle to negotiation as a process where two or more parties decide what each will give and hope to get in their interaction. And this next clause is critical. And through a process of mutual influence and persuasion, there is no command and control in negotiation. You cannot force anyone to say yes. All that you can do is to present proposals where they believe it is in their interest to say yes, and you agree on a common course of action. Now, this definition is sufficiently broad that it can incorporate and encompass adversarial negotiations, as well as situations that you might not even think of as a negotiation. So let me give you two examples from my life. Turns out that I have a lot of addictions. I'll share one with you, that I am addicted to horses. And until recently, I had four. And you might wonder, why would anybody need four? I didn't just need four because, you see, I had a 5-horse trailer. And so I thought, how about five? And I did. I bought Dylan. And Dylan is a wonderful horse, but he's really big. I'm wearing heels today, so his shoulders are about as tall as my eyes. So he's a big guy. But I'm also very safety conscious. So when I bought Dylan, I put all five of my horses into my 5-horse trailer, attached it to my GMC 2500 dually pickup, put in the saddles and the bridles and everything that I would need to transport these animals, plus my husband's butt and my butt into this thing, and suitcases, and we went to a weigh station and weighed combined vehicle to make sure we were within the safety limit. And we weren't. It was too heavy. So, having bought Dylan, I now had to buy a new truck. Okay, I had the 2500 GMC dually. Do you know what a dually is? Okay, some of you are like, The dually is the two wheels in the front and the four wheels in the back, okay? You don't see a lot of them in Silicon Valley, okay? And so, many, many, many years ago, my husband and I, in sort of our early negotiations, agreed that we would work to our expertise. So whenever there was a truck to be purchased or a house to be purchased or a house to be sold, that was my job because I study negotiation. Now you may be asking, what did you get in exchange? Because that give and take in negotiation. My husband is a trained chef. We work to our expertise. In 1992, I know some of you weren't even born then, I left the kitchen. I do not know why you would need a kitchen. I don't understand. I don't know where grocery stores are. Not my job. But on the rare event that I have to negotiate a car or a house or a truck, oh yeah, I do that. So it was the best negotiation of my life. All right, so I go to the truck dealer, right? 3,500 GMCs, not very many of them, but we found one. And my husband and I went in there, and of course I get to negotiate. And it was an adversarial negotiation because he knew that once we were in the truck dealership, there weren't a lot of alternatives in Silicon Valley. I'd have to go all the way to the Central Valley to get a reasonable alternative. And so he was pushing really hard to charge a lot for that truck. And I wanted to pay a little. And I wanted the most luxurious model possible. And he wanted to give me the most basically basic model possible for a lot of money. It's an adversarial negotiation. Not personally adversarial, but certainly structurally. And yesterday, I called my doctoral students to a research meeting. And they showed up. Why? Because I have resources, both tangible and intangible, to which they wish access. And I called those people to a meeting because they have resources, both tangible and intangible, to which I wish access. And while the content of the meeting was about the research project and pushing that project forward, the context of the meeting is, which of my scarce resources will I contribute to this endeavor, and what do I hope to get? And they were doing exactly the same thing. So every meeting where you want to have influence is an opportunity for a negotiation. But you're not going to take advantage of that opportunity if you're going to have to pick a fight every time you negotiate. So rather than thinking about negotiation as a battle. I want you to think about negotiation in a reframed way as collaborative problem solving. Now, don't think that when I say collaborative problem solving, I'm talking about something you may have heard about before. You know, that kind of win-win negotiation where we all get together at the end, we all give group hugs and everybody's great, and there's rainbows and unicorns everywhere? No, I'm not talking about that. When I talk about collaborative problem solving, there are three dimensions that I care about. Number one, the first one, I am better off. As the protagonist in this negotiation, am better off than my status quo, better off than my alternatives, better off than had I not negotiated. Now, that may seem like a low bar, but I suspect that if you guys are honest with yourselves, you will realize that you have, on many occasions, willingly said yes to an outcome that made you worse off because you privileged the yes over the quality of the deal. So number one is, you're better off. Number two, because there is no command and control in negotiation, your counterpart has to willingly walk the path of agreement with you. And so you need to understand who they are, what their interests are, what their preferences are, what their motivations are. You need to understand them because you need to present proposals to them that from their perspective at least keeps them whole or perhaps makes them better off. And third, and most importantly to this perspective, when you make a proposal, you want to frame that proposal as a solution to a problem that your counterpart has. And this is critical, because the good news is people will tell you their problems. If you listen to them, they will tell you what they need. They will tell you why they're interested in you. They will tell you what they want you to do for them to help them solve their problems. You need to listen to that and use that language. But you will also need to prepare for your negotiations and understanding what their problems, preferences, and motives are so that you can present proposals that are good for you, but are framed as solutions to a problem that they have. Now, if you do this, even though it's going to take a lot more work, what happens is everything becomes negotiable now. No longer will you have to pick and choose your targets of negotiation based upon situations where you're willing to pick a fight. And if you take this perspective, what happens is you need to develop fluency. Because I can guarantee you that the strategies and tactics I use with a car dealer, the truck dealer, are a whole lot different than the ones I use with my doctoral students, right? Because it's a different situation, I have different goals and motives, and they have different problems. And so I'm gonna adjust the strategies and tactics. Now, one of the things that I wanna emphasize is that for most of us, and particularly for women, we are so enamored with agreement. And the way I want to demonstrate this, and this study was done actually on a mixed gendered group, but I want you to look at the relative positions of the blue and the orange line. I'm not going to go through all this detail, but the meta message is agreement is not the goal of a negotiation. So I don't care what that book said. You may have heard of that Getting to Yes book. If you haven't, don't look it up, okay? The goal is not to get to yes. That's not the goal. But let me show you how powerful yes is. So in the blue line, this represents the results of folks who were offered the following choices. Choose between option A and option B. This is the percent, the blue line is the percent of folks across a number of different situations who chose option A. Now, option A was a disadvantageous option, but not so crazy disadvantageous that nobody chose it, but you see, depending upon the study, it was either a low of 4% to a high of about 4%. What they did with the orange line, those folks were confronted with exactly the same choice, but rather than labeling the disadvantageous option, option A, they labeled it the agreement option. And look how many more people thought that was an okay outcome by simply changing the label. So, two pieces of insight. Number one, realize that when you are negotiating, folks will say to you, you know, if you can just make this concession, we have an agreement. And they have just lubricated your willingness to say yes. But you can also use that yourself. Wow, if you can just agree to this proposal, then we have an agreement. Okay. But what you want from your negotiation is a good deal, not a deal. And therein lies the difference. But you need to know what a good deal is. And while there are many things and many layers to be able to understand what a good deal is for today, I'm going to give you at least three parameters that you need to pay close attention to. And quite frankly, it doesn't really matter how important or how sort of minor the negotiation is in which you're involved, you should understand these three parameters. The first one is, what happens to you if no agreement were reached? What is your alternative? Alternatives are really important in negotiation because they are a primary source of power. And while there has been tons of research done in the area of agreements and alternatives and their impact on negotiation, we can summarize a lot of that research by saying, she who has the better alternatives on average walks away with more. Why? Why does walking away with more help you do better in your negotiations on average? That's not hypothetical, I'm actually asking. What do you think? Yes. Because it allows you more leeway to walk away. Your biggest source of power in a negotiation is your ability to convince the other side that you will walk away. Now, that's the good news. Here's the bad news. Most of us use our alternatives, and we say, if this is what happens to me if I don't get a deal, then that's the standard by which I judge what the deal I want is. We use it as a standard of acceptability. And I'm going to suggest to you that that is a way that you limit your outcomes. Because once you put your alternative as a standard of acceptability, you anchor yourself to that perception. So rather than thinking about your alternative as a standard of what's okay, you should think about your alternative as a safety net. Imagine yourself a trapeze artist, and you're performing before a large audience. And somewhere in your act, something happens, and you end up in the safety net. You're not going to leap out of that safety net and look to your audience with an expectation of, ta-da! But if you're in that safety net, you're really glad it's there. That's how you think about your alternative. It's not it's what protects you from the fall. It's not a standard of what you want to achieve. Number two is your reservation price, that point of indifference between a yes and a no. The point of indifference between a yes, you should be so indifferent if you are at your bottom line that you could flip a coin. And if it comes up heads, you say yes, and if it comes up tails, you say no. That's how indifferent you should be. Your reservation price is a bright line standard that you do not violate. How easy that is to say. How hard that is to do. I know that many of you live and work in the Bay Area, but some of you may have attempted to do something almost impossible around here, which is to buy a house. Anybody here ever? Yeah, so when you bought your first house, think about the first time. And probably as you contemplated buying a house, you did a reasonable preparation. You said, how much house can we afford? And you and your partner, you and your parents, whoever was going to help you fund this impossible dream, right? You did an analysis and you came up with a number, the most that we could pay. That would be your reservation price. Now, let's say you work with a real estate agent. Wisely, you do not tell that person your reservation price. That would be stupid. Because arguably, your reservation price is the most strategic piece of information in a negotiation. But you probably said something like, we'd like to look at houses in this range. And so you begin the search, and you look, and you look, and you look. And you get more and more desperate. Because the houses that you're shown, you've seen pictures of them. You don't even have to be there. You know they are like disgusting. And you're wondering, I'm going to pay all this money for all these years, and this is what I get? Your real estate agent, seeing your desperation, says to you, I'm sorry we haven't found a place that sings to you, that sparks joy. There are a few houses that I haven't shown you because they are out of the range you gave me, but I think you might like them. Would you like to see them? Desperate, you say yes. So you look, and of course you find the house. And it's wonderful. But it doesn't matter how well you negotiate. You cannot get the price to be below your reservation price. So what should you do? Thank you. What do you do? You use that incredible cognitive capacity of yours to explain to you and everybody else why that number you came up with in the cold calmness before you fell into lust is wrong. And now you'll think things like, well, we have kids, but they're smart. They don't need a college fund. We'll put that money. They'll have scholarships. Or have you seen the kitchen in that house? We will never have to go out to dinner again. We can put that money in. And living in that house, a vacation 24/7. We gotta have that place. And then you hope you're not the victim of yet another Bay Area bubble. Yeah, okay. But you see, this is the problem. For even those of us who set a reservation price, it's really hard to have the discipline to honor that reservation price because we so want to get to yes. And this is a challenge. But if all you focus on is your alternative, your safety net, or your bottom line, you will systematically underperform because what you have done is you have set low expectations for yourself. So what you must also do is literally leverage up your expectations about what is possible. And that is through the use of an aspiration, an optimistic assessment of what you could achieve in this negotiation. Expectations are powerful forces in life as well as in negotiations. You set your expectations. One of the problems, one of the reasons that women have trouble in negotiations is because you have systematically lower expectations. So you need to understand the power of expectations, to optimistic assessment. That, notice those words, optimistic and assessment. It's not a first number you might throw out that you don't have any commitment to. You've done your homework. You've said, okay, based upon my situation, who I am, what I've got, what my alternatives are, if things went really well in this negotiation, what could I hope to achieve? And you need to focus on that number. And it turns out doing that will, on average, improve your performance in your negotiations. Now, you may not reach that aspiration, but you'll do better. And let me tell you why this is so important. So this is a study that was done by some colleagues of mine. It's one of my favorite studies. And the reason is, I want you to look at the greenish-blue bars first. So what happened here is negotiators negotiated, and then they got their result for themselves. That's all they knew about, you know, how well did I do. And as you might expect, given what I've just said, the folks who focus on their aspiration, the folks here on the left-hand side, had higher performance. Let's see, is this gonna work? Yes. You can see that the blue bar is up here, way up here, that's outcome, compared to those who focus on their alternative. Right? Expectations drive behavior, said aspirations on average do better. Good. But the researchers were very clever, and they asked a second question. They said to the negotiators who had just received their results, they knew how well they did, how satisfied are you with your results? Look at what appears to be a paradox. More is better than less. I get more, I'm less satisfied. I get less, I'm more satisfied. How can this be? How can I be happier with less? It's all about expectations. When you look at these graphs and what I've just said, there should be three very important learnings. Number one, be an adult. Set an aspiration, knowing full well that you will be less satisfied with the outcome because you set that aspiration. But being adult requires you to be psychologically mature, to approach uncomfortable situations, right? So do that. If you won't be happy, okay, that's fine. Sometimes life is not about being happy all the time, okay? Number two, focus your counterpart on their alternatives. Because when they exceed their alternatives in their negotiations with you, they will feel very satisfied with their performance. And because you are the person across the table from them, they will want to negotiate with you in the future. They will like negotiating with you. And third, and most importantly, what this result says is that we are abysmal in assessing how well we did in a negotiation by how good we feel. In fact, the correlation between our objective performance and our subjective assessment of that performance is zero to negative. So, when you think you did a really good job in a negotiation, you should be concerned, because you probably didn't. But what I want to highlight here is the power of the aspiration to change behaviors. You want to focus your counterpart, make them feel good, and you want to have the maturity to accept the sense that you could have done better, because you're seeing what could have been, and you see what is, and you see that discrepancy. And you want them to look at that alternative and see how much better they did and feel really good. And by the way, it's really simple to focus your counterpart on their alternative. All you have to do is use sort of their natural tendencies. You can say to them, oh, when you get to a rough part in the negotiation, perhaps you might say, wow, it's getting harder and harder to think we might have a successful outcome. And I guess if we don't, we'll just have to rely on our alternatives. And let their mind go where it will. Up to them. All right. But is that enough? Would that be enough? That would be great. So, but it's not. Women, why women need to negotiate. This is okay, this gets really depressing, so let me just, okay. So a colleague of mine did a study, 184 managers in a very large organization. She put those 184 managers into two conditions. In the first condition, these managers, both males and female managers, were asked to allocate raises from a fixed pool to their subordinates, male and female, who were equally performing and equally responsible. Okay, so there should be no difference. In the first condition, which was, please make these allocations based upon the performance of your subordinates. And when you make those allocations, that's done. There's no subsequent issue. There was no difference in the raises they gave to their male and female subordinates. But in the second condition, she said, the same thing, except that when you give the raises, they can come back and talk to you. They can ask you why you did what you did. They can negotiate. And you know what happened when they did that? The male and female managers gave the men 2.5 times the raises they gave the women. And this is before anybody had a chance to negotiate. There was this huge difference. Why? Why did they privilege the men over the women? Why do you think? Well, you already asked the question, was already asked and answered. Women don't come and negotiate, right? They don't negotiate. But the men would. But not every man. We've given the guys enough. Maybe they'll go away. And so 2.5 times they gave. They took from Kathy to give to Bill. Because they thought Bill's going to be in my office. But Kathy, she won't. She'll take whatever I give her. Okay. So even if you do negotiate, you're starting way down. Okay. Well, why don't you negotiate? Well, it turns out there's at least two big reasons. And this is not just for you personally, but for people in general. The first is, you don't even think of it as an option. When you're facing a situation, you say, we don't negotiate here. It's not done. To give you my favorite example of that is, how many of you have ever heard of a store called Nordstrom's? Anybody here? Mm-hmm. Anybody ever been there? Bought anything? Negotiated the price. I got one. Yeah. Why not? Why didn't you attempt to negotiate? What stopped you? Price tag. What does that mean? Price tag. You mean there's a fixed price, right? And if you want a sale, wait for the sale, right? Yeah. Maybe that stopped you. Maybe here's another thing that probably stopped you. The clerk hasn't got the authority. So what happens? You think the clerk can't do anything, so what do? Great, nothing. You don't. You don't ask. Why? Because the clerk can't do anything. Why would I bother? So what happens? Nothing. And you say, ta-da, I knew I was right. It's called a self-fulfilling prophecy. Have you ever been to a store where you're about to purchase something and the seller says to you, stop, you're paying too much. Let's negotiate.
No.
Right? You're going to have to initiate. You may also think that if I try to negotiate at Nordstrom's, a reasonably upscale department store, that they will think that I can't afford this stuff. I'll be embarrassed. We've actually done the surveys, and it turns out, what do you think the correlation is between wealth and willingness to negotiate? Is it positive? Wealthy people negotiate more? Or negative? Poor people negotiate more? It's positive. Wealthy people are like, I could pay that. I don't choose to. If you want to sell it, you're going to have to negotiate. Poor people are like, this sounds like a joke, but it's not. I don't want people to think I'm poor, so I'll pay full price. Yeah? Seriously. So, but there's more to life than shoe shopping at Nordstrom. I understand that. So let's look at the second reason. And by the way, there's homework for you. Go to Nordstrom's. Find something you like. Negotiate. And by the way, even if you negotiate and you're successful, you don't have to buy it. You can say, oh, I changed my mind. Thank you. Or even if you like it and you're not successful, because not every one of you will be successful, you could still buy it because they will not take your picture after you've negotiated. Put it up on the cash register and say, she can't buy here anymore. She behaved badly. All right. The second reason, and probably the most important one for today, is that we are concerned about the adversarial nature, the battle mentality in negotiation. We're concerned that our counterparts will perceive us, if we negotiate, as greedy or demanding or not nice. And so we say to ourselves, here's what I'm going to do. When you're confronted with the offer of a job or perhaps a promotion, here's what I'm going to do. I could negotiate. I know other people negotiate in this situation, but I'm concerned that they will think I'm greedy or demanding or just simply not nice. So I'm going to take that job or I'm going to take that promotion and I'm going to do really good work. And when they see that good work, then they will reward me, parenthetical, because the world is fair, close parentheses. Anybody ever have that thought? How'd it work out for you? Did not, thank you. Yeah, I'm pretty sure my dean likes me. I do a lot of good things for the school. But I'm also equally sure that when I do it, he might even say, Maggie, that was great. We really appreciate what you're doing for us. He's not thinking in the next clause, are we paying her enough? No, he's not. And so, as a result, he's got a lot on his mind. The notion of his having to decide whether he's paying me enough and giving him that authority is really basically giving up my agency, my ability to control my own life. I'm going to ask if I think I need to have more. Now, the problem is faced by women particularly is that we historically don't ask. And you can sort of think about this. We don't even have to be in like business. We can be in tennis. There was a wonderful article in the New York Times in 2006. I literally was eating breakfast one day reading, and I saw this, and I went, oh, my God, it's everywhere. And what it was this was a story about the U.S. Tennis Grand Slam tournament had just installed an instant replay process. They'd never had one before. And so they limited the challenges to a specific number, and they controlled for the number of games that the men's and the women's tennis players played. And what they did is they did an analysis of what happened. And they found that once, when a call was challenged by the tennis player, there was no difference by gender in how often the player, the call was adjudicated in the player's favor, about a third of the time. The calls were adjudicated in the player's favor. But what they found was a huge difference in the number of calls that were challenged. Controlling for the number of games played, the men challenged almost 3 times more calls than the women did. Now, maybe men's tennis is faster, and maybe the judges are prone to more mistakes. Maybe. Maybe the judges are paying closer attention to the women. Maybe. Or maybe even these top-seeded women don't ask. And by the way, the study was redone in 2013. If you think in 2006 was too long ago, 2013, no difference in the results. No difference by gender in the calls and the adjudications, 3 times more likely that men would challenge a call than women. So, we have to negotiate. Well, if you go back, Linda Babcock, and some of you may know her name because she did a book with Sarah Lashevere called Women Don't Ask, Negotiation in the Gender Divide. And what motivated her to do that was her time as an associate dean at the Graduate School of Business at Carnegie Mellon. And what she found when they did the exit survey while she was an associate dean was that the starting salaries of Carnegie Mellon MBAs was 7.6% higher if they were male than if they were female, right? And you can look at that result and we kind of all just nod our heads and go, yeah, what else is new? You know, we can think about it in terms of comparable worth concerns. We can think about it as institutionalized sexism. We can think about it as the mommy penalty or the daddy benefit. There are all sorts of explanations we've given. But Linda was a negotiations researcher. And so she added a few other questions to the survey. And her first question, additional question was, when you got your offer, did you attempt to negotiate the terms of your employment contract? And she found a surprising difference. Only 7% of the women said they attempted to negotiate, while 57% of the men did. And she said, okay, well, if you did negotiate, what happened? No differences in success by gender. So once you attempted to negotiate, both male and female negotiators were equally successful. On average, the students who negotiated got a 7.4% increase in their salaries. Now, at this point, sometimes my students become, my MBA students, my female MBA students are taking negotiations because they often see my class as the equivalent of going to the dentist. They know it's good for them. They don't really want to do it. And they say to me, Professor Neal, because they're very polite, let's say a salary is at $100,000, because it's easy to do the math in your head when you're standing up in public. Is $7,000 worth that potential reputational hit? And I'm actually really disappointed in that question. So let's see if you guys can do a better job than my MBA students. So I'm going to give you a little thought experiment. Suppose at age 30, we have 2 equally qualified applicants, Chris and Frazier, who both get offers of jobs from the same company for $100,000 a year. Now, Chris negotiates, gets $107,600. Frazier accepts the $100,000. Now, we're going to make 2 heroic assumptions. Number one, Chris and Frazier stay at the same company for the next 35 years. Okay? So we can see what happens. And number two, the company treats them identically. There's no difference. So every year they get the same 5% raise. Now I know we were talking about big numbers here, you know, earlier, $70 million and stuff. Yeah, well don't, that's what academics get as raises. That's why we're using this as a number. We get about 5%, okay? We're not gonna, okay, don't snooze, please. All right, so the question I'm asking you, at age 65, Chris and Frazier. Well, Chris decides to retire. And the question I would ask you is, how many more years will Frazier have to work until Frazier has all the money that Chris had from the company? Right? I'm not asking about how well they invested. I'm asking just inflow. How many more years? You're close. It's only 8. But it's 8. So it's not $7,000, it's 8 years of your life. So at this point, I know you can't do it, can you?
No.
So 8 years of your life, is that worth it? You may not like negotiating, but 8 years of your life. And by the way, this is a very, very, very conservative estimate. Because by the time that 35 years has gone by, the difference between Chris and Frazier and their annual salary exceeds $100,000 a year. So how does a company explain to itself why this salary difference exists? Does somebody say, oh, you remember 35 years ago? Chris negotiated, Frazier didn't? No, nobody can know why. What do they say? Chris is better. That's why we pay Chris so much more. So we're not going to give Chris that same paltry 5% raise that we give Frazier. We're still cheap. So we're going up to 5.5%. So of those 35 years, we give Chris 5.5%. We give Frazier 5%. Now how many more years? Okay, yes. 18 years. Okay, here's the last one, then I'll stop. It doesn't take very much. 6%. Chris gets 6, Frazier gets 5.
25.
You might be thinking, well, Frazier's probably a woman. She's going to live longer. She can't live longer. Okay, yeah, we do live longer on average, but not this much longer. She won't make it. So, you don't want to negotiate, that's fine. That's your choice. 7, 8 to 47 years of your life. And if you're still willing now not to negotiate, congratulations, I hope you like your job. You'll be there for a lot longer, getting a lot less. Absolutely. All right. Expectations drive behavior. Don't notice I talk about Carnegie Mellon, I talk about Harvard, I don't mention Stanford. That's just, that was intentional. But another of my colleagues, well, actually my doctoral student, Kathleen McGinn, who's on faculty at Harvard, did a study. What she found was that female Harvard graduates got 6% lower than their male colleagues, but their bonuses, this more ambiguous component, much like equity, right?
They make the connection.
Right? Much like equity, they were 19% different. And they attempted to do everything they could control for industries these MBAs entered, they control for their pre-MBA salaries, for their functional areas of specialization in the MBA program, and the cities of employment, and they still found this difference. It's depressing, but wait, there's more, it's better. These differences disappeared when men and women had the same expectations about the going rates. When the equate expectations would begin to equate outcomes, expectations drive behaviors.
So let me just demonstrate how powerful these expectations can be. This was a study that was done, and they had male and female negotiators. In every negotiation pair, there was a male and a female negotiator. And these pairs were randomly assigned to one of two conditions, the negative male stereotype condition or the negative female stereotype condition. In the negative male stereotype condition, the negotiators, both male and female, were told that negotiators who display the following behaviors tend to perform worse. They have a high regard for their personal interests. They depend on assertive behaviors. They rely on rational analysis, and they have limited displays of emotion. Those people do worse. In the negative female stereotype condition, the negotiators, both male and female, were told that negotiators who display the following behavior tend to perform worse. They are passive or reactive in expressing their interest. They depend on their own listening skills. They rely on intuition, and they're willing to share their emotion. Those people do worse. And now they were asked to set their aspiration, both these male and female negotiators. And here's what the results found. When folks got the negative male stereotyped information, the female negotiators in the pair had higher aspirations than their male counterparts. When they got the negative female information, the males had higher aspirations for their performance than their female counterparts. And this pattern of data suggests that the women were more reactive to the negative female stereotype than the men were to the negative male stereotype, probably because most folks think of negotiation as an agentic or masculine activity, right? So didn't quite affect them as strongly as it did the females. Now, but this is aspiration. What about performance? Well, when you get the negative female information, The women were outperformed by their male counterparts. This is a huge and significant difference. But when they got the negative male information, the women outperformed their male counterparts. There's no difference between here and here, although it looks like it might be, it's not significant. There's no difference between here and here. The only differences are these two. To the extent that we can, by changing expectations, change outcomes, suggests that this is malleable, that negotiation performance, the finding that women don't negotiate or we get less, is malleable. We can change that. Part of the way we change that is by changing our expectations. But why is it that with something so simple as changing our expectations, we don't ask? And there's a lot of reasons for that. But the biggest one is, when negotiating a single issue like, compensation, we get penalized, particularly if our counterpart is a male, in ways that our males do not. So let's say that we have a particular script, and I, as a female, embody that script. I negotiate with you and I use those words. Or, in the alternate reality, I'm a male and I use that exact same script. I'm going to do better as a male, because what's going to happen with me as a female is there's going to be a backlash, because people will perceive me as greedy, demanding, and not nice. And we've learned that. We have low expectations and we get backlash. There's a reason why we don't negotiate. Now, there's a little bit of good news here. If my evaluator's female, she penalizes both males and females for that. At least it's a level playing field, but yeah, okay. But still, the issue is, why do I get the pushback? Because people perceive me as greedy, as demanding, and not nice. And the role of women, especially in this culture, is to make people feel good. And you don't make people feel good when you're asking them for money. So to simply continue doing the same thing over and over again and getting bad outcomes seems crazy behavior. So let's think about how we might do something different. And let me suggest to you, I've already given you the answer. Let me reaffirm it. You need to ask differently. The problem-solving orientation. You see, what we know from research is that this attribution of being greedy and demanding and not nice gets muted when I pair my ask with a communal concern for the other. Now, that's a lot of words, but let me tell you what that means. I'm going to help you solve your problems. You see, it's really hard for people to think that I'm greedy, demanding, and not nice if I'm helping you solve your problems. And so embrace the collaborative problem-solving perspective, especially that third point. Now, the good news is that this actually works for both genders, but it's particularly important for women. Because if we simply express in our ask our competence, we will be perceived more negatively. That communal concern for the others is the critical factor, and I have characterized that as this collaborative problem-solving approach. Let me tell you how I can help you. And even when you're asking for more, for a compensation package, you can do that in a way that says to the other side, here's what I can do for you with these resources. So, a couple of things I'm going to ask of you. And these are questions you need to ask yourself. Number one, if you have been reticent in asking for what you want, how will others know what it is you want? If you're not willing to ask for what you want, you're asking your counterparts to mind read. And we human beings are notoriously terrible mind readers. Number two, if you don't ask for what you want, who will? Who will be your agent? Now, here's the good news. You see, that's been all bad and depressing. Now we're gonna right up. Okay. It turns out that if you distill all the research on gender and negotiation, you get two very interesting and oppositional findings. Number one, when I negotiate for myself, on average, as a female, I get less.
for all the reasons we've talked about. But this is why you should always hire women lawyers. Because when people negotiate, when women negotiate for others, they outperform men between 14 and 22%. Because you see what happens when I negotiate for others, no longer am I the greedy, demanding, and not nice person. You know, she fought like a lion for us. She's awesome. We don't say, greedy, greedy, greedy. It's very different. And so this is a very important finding. It says that the resistance to negotiating and getting good outcomes is under your control. Because when they take away that social kind of thing about, oh, you're just not a nice person, all of a sudden you're like awesome in negotiating. And I cannot tell you how many executives and CEOs, female, they're not that many, but the small number that I know, have said to me, I can negotiate for my company, no problem, but to go to my board and ask for more, that's really hard to do. And so the question I would ask you is, that's the result, in case you want to see it, notice just this point right over here. It's like, when I negotiate for others, I'm awesome, okay? For whom do you negotiate? Because it turns out having someone to negotiate for frees you up. So maybe you're negotiating for your team. Maybe you're negotiating for your organization. Or maybe, if you haven't got those folks, you're negotiating for all the women who come after you, so no longer will they be taking from Kathy to give to Bill because they say, she'll just take it. She won't complain. No, I will. I will. And so as a result, you need to think about that. Now for me, one of the things that I have decided is that I actually have a whole cadre of folks I negotiate for. I often negotiate for people who come after me, but I also negotiate for my 9 chickens, my 5 horses, my 3 dogs, and my husband. I'm the only source of income for that entire group. I have lots of responsibility. And this is the critical crux. How much are you willing to pay to potentially avoid the perception that you are greedy or demanding or not nice? And I put all of these qualitative words in there because as you move up in the organization, or as you are a founder in your own organization, when you're a leader, not everybody's going to like you. And if that's so important to you, I do have a solution. So when I come home today after teaching, and having this talk, I'm teaching this afternoon to a group of executives, my husband will say to me, how'd your day go, dear? And I'll go, it's good. And he goes, great. And he goes back to doing whatever he was doing. Right? My dogs, I have 3. I walk in the door and they're like, oh, you're back! Our lives were dull and dark and sad. And we never thought you'd return. You've been gone forever. And now you're back and we are happy and life is good. I've been married for 38 years. My husband has never greeted me with that kind of enthusiasm. So, if you really need to be liked, get a dog. And better yet, get a rescue and save 2 lives. Thank you, yes. But you have to be strategic in how you ask. It's not that you shouldn't ask, you need to ask in a collaborative, problem-solving way, and take the responsibility to find a way to frame your asks as solutions to problems that your counterpart has. Now, if you want to know more, there are a couple of things, a couple of books I recommend to you. Let me tell you, the first one is, I told you the book that Sarah Lashevere and Linda Babcock wrote in 2003, Women Don't Ask. In 2009, they put together a book that was designed for practitioners, because the first book was research-oriented, so if you love to hear about t-tests and sample sizes and degrees of freedom, the 2003 book is awesome, but if you just want to know what do I need to know, to this 2009 book, Ask For It, How Women Can Use the Power of Negotiating to Get What They Really Want. If you have not read Robert Cialdini's work on influence, get it.
His book in 2009 was the last version of a book that he's been writing for a number of years. It's an awesome book. If you have not read it, you should get it. He is also recently, he's gone emeritus, and so he's no longer a faculty member, but he continues to write. His latest book was 2016, Persuasion, How Do You Set the Ground for Impressive Influence? And then he has another book in 2014 called The Small Big, Small Things You Can Do That Have Big Influence. So a couple of strategies. You got the book, Neo and Lise. If you like it, it's a holiday gift. It's amazing. Okay, it really works well. Also, my voice will eventually fade from your memory. You'll think about things that I've told you today, but in a week or a month or a year, it'll be like, well, what did you say? So to the extent that my voice fades and you want a re-inoculation, go to the website, gettingmoreofwhatyouwant.com. It's got video clips, blog posts, articles, things that we've written. There's even a really short video clip of my co-author. He's kind of shy, so he hates to be in videos. I don't care. Also, we have two virtual negotiation opportunities that Stanford has. This is just a little commercial. Stanford Innovation Entrepreneurship Certificate and the Stanford LEAD Program, which is a hybrid. These are virtual, and the Stanford one, the second one is a virtual and live hybrid. So let me suggest those opportunities. And with that, I have a few minutes for questions. Thank you. So way back here, what's your question?
My question is, how do you think regulations, for example, that companies can't ask women what their salary is before will impact how women negotiate and how salaries?
So the question is, you know, how will this new law in California that prohibits people from saying, what did you make before? I think this is an awesome innovation. And what happens is because what people do is they use your prior salary as some kind of metric for what you're worth. But even if you are negotiating in states where they don't have such a law, and there are many, you may want to ask the person, well, why is that even meaningful? Because I'm not actually applying for that job. I'm applying for this job. And what are the differences, right, that are incumbent in this job? And what is this job worth? And part of it is, how prepared are you? How much do you know? But as a general rule, this is a really good outcome. Yes, ma'am.
I have two questions. One is, do you negotiate at
our term? Yes. So first is, I don't actually think that we have pay equity. I can tell you that there are organizations in this environment who characterize themselves as data-driven, and you know, it's just about performance. And I will tell you that there are huge disparities. Because it turns out that it's particularly problematic in organizations that characterize themselves with pride as data driven, because what happens then, what happens is a psychological process called moral licensing. And you all know what moral licensing is deep down in your hearts. This is when you've worked out really hard, so you give yourself permission to have that bag of chips or that piece of cake. That's moral licensing. I've already proved I'm a good person by working out, I'll take the cake. Moral licensing in this situation says, because we're in an organization that promotes equity and performance and data-driven assessments, I don't have to worry about my assessments. Because by nature of being in this organization, I've already proved myself to be with the angels. So now, I'll just do what I want. Because what happens is, we have non-conscious processes that are not available to our conscious mind that affect these outcomes. And that systematic affecting of those outcomes makes pay equity almost impossible unless you have truly transparent. And if you are transparent, congratulations, you're one of the few. Because most people say, oh, I don't want other people to know because they'll feel badly or they'll feel good. You know, let me just tell you empirically, if you don't have transparent pay,
people always assume that people who are like them are making more. Yes, I do negotiate at Nordstrom's because I'm a shoeaholic. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. Also, as a manager, what are the tools, the courses, the books that we can recommend to our higher-ups? Because one thing I have found is that people, especially women, try to negotiate. And then when it gets up higher, they always find a reason not to give that parity, even when people are asking and coming to the table. So I found this only with so much we can do, but I find that these are questions that I would like higher ups to answer and to give them resources that they can look to, because this affects every woman, I think, in this company.
Well, I think part of the problem is that one of the reasons, the finding I told you, which is that women actually punish both men and women for attempting to negotiate, is that they are uncomfortable with negotiation, right? And they feel like, well, I didn't get to do it, so you shouldn't either and leave me alone, right? The problem is that that's oftentimes because they see it as a battle, right? So first is, as the change agent yourself, think about this as collaborative problem solving. But I can certainly tell you that there's a huge amount of resources, but the notion is, do they think it's worth their effort? And that's the other problem. And one of the things is, and I thought you actually were going to a different place because I already had a great answer for you for the other question. Here's the other question that I thought you were going to ask. How do I get my underlings to negotiate? And part,
I teach them that.
Yeah, that's what I mean, exactly. You need to be developing your subordinates to say, you know, this is what you normally do. Just, you know, come on in and talk to me about this. And let's think about how you can frame these proposals, right?
But it's built in, I think, discrimination, because, like, we get a pool of money, right? And they've already kind of decided because it's that pool and these numbers and metrics and all these things. And so I had a discussion. I was like, no, this is unfair. It's inherently unfair because you've already told me that this is what she should get. If I go over, it's red and blue.
Yes.
And I'm like, well, no, because you've already built in this and it's not fair. And then I was just told, why? But I mean, I want to take that next step to say something wrong.
So I have a great solution, but it's very self-interested. We have a new course called Diverse by Design, and what we are focusing on are the hiring and performance appraisal biases that exist and ways that organizations can change that. So talk to me afterwards, we can talk about that. Over on this side, in the beige pinky shirt there. Yes, I can. Number one, do not ask for a raise for yourself. Package. Remember Henry up here talked about a package? Focus on the package. You get your most powerful pushback and backlash. I want more money. No. Here's a package of resources that I need in order to do my job better. Here are the things I can do for you if I have these resources. Oh, yes, there is money for me. It's a salary in there. Right, but focus on the package and not a single issue, because that zero, remember that there was a slide a few slides ago said compensation, negotiation, most, that's where you get the biggest pushback. Don't do that. And by the way, even if you offer a package, here's what I'd like, this package of resources is what I need to do my job better. They may not give you everything, but they will probably give you something. And the question you need to ask yourself, and this is something I tell my doctoral students and my MBA students, this is your first job, your second job, it's not your last job. What you want to do is you want to be competitive for the next job, and what are the resources that you need? And yes, more money is better than less. I will not dispute that. But what are the other resources? And so for my doctoral students, yeah, the salary is great, but you want tenure. And in order to get tenure, you have to be research productive, which means you need to have resources for your research. So if you have to make a choice between salary and research resources, choose the research. In the very back there.
I have a question about setting yourself. When I saw the manager, I manage a bunch of people, and I've been reading their feedback about themselves. They have to write feedback about themselves, and men consider their right more positive feedback about themselves than women. And as a woman, I like it, because I'm like, you're so honest, this is what I would do, this is great. Like, they grade themselves more realistically, but not based on what they achieve, what they think they achieve. Men are like, I'm like expert on this. I'm like, what's like this? I mean, as a woman, I like the woman feedback, but like seeing all these things, I don't know how in the long term that would affect. Because I would write the feedback for myself.
myself the same way, but I don't know how to advise for you. I don't want to be like, oh, you should also write like men do. I don't have the answer yet, but I don't know what to do.
Well, there are parts of the answer there, and one of the challenges is that performance appraisal evaluations are a minefield for women. And they are because we have low expectations, we have low assessments of how well we did, and we get feedback that is not helpful. I'm not saying this is what you do, but on average, women get feedback that is non-diagnostic. You know, you need to work on your communication skills. Thanks for sharing. What does that mean? There was a study done at the Clayman Center. It's a wonderful resource. If you guys don't know about the Clayman Center for Gender Studies at Stanford, you should get online. It's great. There was a study where they got three tech firms and one consulting firm, and they got all the performance evaluations for those four organizations. And they ran an analysis of those evaluations, and they found some very depressing results by gender. Number one, the male evaluations were longer and more detailed and had more business-specific evaluations. You did well on this because blah, blah, blah. Here's where you fell down. This is what you need to do. 76% of the instances where someone was told that they were too aggressive in these four organizations were women. Seriously? Oh yeah, we're out there just ripping people's throats out. 24% were men, yeah. Also, women were given vague feedback, and when they were given vague feedback, their performance suffered. So part of the issue is, number one, we need to be more specific in the kinds of feedback that we give our subordinates, particularly our female subordinates. We need to make sure there's parity in the types of feedback we give. Secondly, one of the things you'd also need to do in terms of development is to really focus your subordinates on actually telling you what they did well. And they should take it as part of the performance appraisal process. It's not just, you know, okay, I was part of a village and this is what we did. And it's like, well, what did you do? Tell me more about what you did. What were your contributions? And characterize that. Yes, there were people who helped, but you need to be more confident, because here's the problem. This is one of the biggest problems. Confidence versus competence. We get confused. We think that confident people are competent. They're not. They're just confident. We just actually recently did a study where we found that, and this especially, this turns out to be a very clear status difference. High status people tend to be more confident, and by nature of their confidence, are perceived to be more competent, even when their status has no benefit to their competence. So just be aware of that. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that we get confused about, right?
I'm going to jump in here because...
Yes, time is up.
We have a break, but wow, Maggie. Thank you. Thank you.
If you want to find out about Maggie's research, you can find her at gettingmoreofwhatyouwant.com or on Twitter at Maggie Neal, MaggieNeale. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes or wherever you are listening right now to rate and review it. You can also find us at tbtpodcast.com. Tomorrow Built Today is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. The theme music you heard today is by Mikhail Manvayan.